It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everybody. And the Jeopardy answer is, about to retire from Congress, he is the only member of the House of Representatives to be a Jeopardy champion and even defeat What's in the Computer on the show. The question, who is Rush Holt? This will be a big year for turnover in Congress. You know, lots of members retiring or likely to be knocked out by the current political turmoil, including three from New Jersey. But the big retirement in our area, the most distinctive voice that we will now lose, is that of Rush Holt, the eight-term New Jersey Democrat, the Princeton physicist whose supporters had bumper stickers reading, "My congressman is a rocket scientist." Rush Holt just announced his plans to retire this month, and he joins me now. Congressman, welcome back to WNYC. And your seat looked to be very safe again this year. So tell us why, and why now?
Oh, thanks, Brian. It's good to be with you. I always appreciate listening to you, and thanks for taking some time to talk now. First of all, I am not using the word retire. I hope that I'm not muted. You say we'd be losing my voice. I hope not. I still intend to be involved. I've been deeply invested in this representation of the people of Central New Jersey, and I don't give that up easily. But I found that Americans want, I think my constituents want, representatives who have a life before Congress and a life after Congress, who are not a politician class or professional politicians or whatever the phrasing is. I find I'm getting a lot of feedback from my constituents, most of it very positive. There's a little bit of good riddance, but most of it's very positive, and I think supportive of the idea that a member of Congress would consider things other than electability. I've had electoral successes, and probably with some hard work could have continued electoral successes, but that's not what it's about, I don't think.
So
I never intended to be in this job forever, and nor do I think my constituents would want me to be.
Well, at age 65, many would say you're too young to retire. I know you say you don't want to use that word. Look at Charlie Rangel. Look at half of them. Your mom is still alive at 101, I read. That's correct?
She turns 101 in a few months. Yes, that's right.
So she's 100.
She's doing quite well.
So you're likely to have a good few years ahead of you. So are you primarily giving up on a dysfunctional institution to try to channel your energies into things that you think might be more productive?
Well, I won't deny that Congress has had more frustrations for me than in the previous, in the last few years than in the previous dozen years. But that's not really the reason. It just seems that it's time. And there are a number of reasons, but really they are all positive and optimistic. I am still a great believer in the ingenuity, the genius of our constitutional representation system. I'm not throwing up my hands by any means. 65 that is indeed my age, and it's a time maybe to think about what else one might want to do. And I have, I think, a number of possibilities.
Listeners, if you want to talk to Rush Holt before he leaves Congress, 212-433-WNYC. First priority if you're in his district or anyone else, 212-433-9692 or post to WNYC.org. And let's talk about the House of Representatives. I mean, because of redistricting in 2010, the House looks likely to be dominated by Republicans for the foreseeable future, even though more Americans voted Democratic for Congress than Republican in 2012. Do you think anything can be done to make the partisan balance of the House more accurately reflect the electoral will of the American people?
Well, the the redistricting problem that, and I would call it a problem that you present, where more Americans vote Democratic and more Americans favor Democratic platform planks and principles than Republican, and yet there are more Republican representatives in Congress, that isn't easily fixed. It's partly because Democrats tend to be concentrated in a number of places around the country, particularly urban areas. And so it would be very difficult to draw congressional districts that made the numbers, you know, come out really proportional to the Democratic and Republican votes. Nevertheless, I do think there's a lot of room for Democratic gains. I'm not about to predict what's going to happen this year yet, but I think Democrats can do a better job with their message. You know, whether you're looking at, well, some of the issues of the day that are talked about, such as minimum wage and social insurance programs and food and nutrition support and those things, people favor the Democratic positions. And so Democrats have to talk about those in a better way, a more convincing way. And then there are a number of other issues having to do with environmental protection and climate change, civil liberties and curtailing domestic surveillance and so forth, where Democrats in recent years have not been as outspoken as they could be. And I think there's a lot of support to be gained in some of those areas.
Let me follow up on one of those, and especially since you're a scientist, a physicist, turned congressman, you've been a big advocate of climate policy based on science. Do you think the deniers in Congress are ignorant of the science, genuinely disbelieve the science, or lie about the science for political reasons, even though they get it?
Well, there, you know, there are 435 members of Congress, and quite a variety of intellects, quite a variety or degrees of intellectualism, and as well as quite a range of positions. So it's all of those things, but I think most of it is willful ignorance. There is a certain amount of effect that comes from Koch brothers and others spending enormous amounts of money to plant uncertainty. It's reminiscent of the tobacco debates of several decades ago, where tobacco companies were spending a lot of money just to plant seeds of doubt about whether cigarettes caused cancer. You know, it's statistical. We all know somebody who's 80 or 90 years old has been smoking all their lives and are still alive. But, you know, you can play on people's inability to think statistically to sow seeds of doubt that make them question whether, you know, cigarettes should be regulated. And similarly, seeds of doubt about climate change. Why, it's been cold this winter. Surely there isn't global warming. Well, it's been cold in New York, but it's been warm other places. And the importance is not the average temperature of the Earth, but the fluctuations that are caused by climate change. You know, scientists would call them fluctuations. We would call them storms and hurricanes and droughts and you know, barges running aground on the Mississippi or whatever. And
look at the Summer Olympics they could have just staged in Sochi with that weather.
Exactly, yes. So some of it is willful ignorance, and some of it is responding to the constituents who have been led to believe that the science isn't clear. Now, you know, science is never absolutely positively conclusive. One of the benefits of thinking like a scientist is remaining open to evidence that will lead you to a different conclusion. But the evidence is so strong on climate change that we'd be foolish. In fact, we are being foolish not to act on it and take strong action.
New Jersey Congressman Rush Holt leaving office at the end of this year after 16 years in Congress. Let's hear from one of your constituents, Cynthia in East Brunswick. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I love your show.
Thank you.
And I love Rush Holt. And I moved to New Jersey 5 years ago from New York City. And I write to Rush Holt all the time, voicing my opinions, on which he's pretty much in the same boat as me. And I appreciate that. But particularly, we adopted our daughter from Colombia, South America. And when we were in Colombia, there were all sorts of paperwork problems with Homeland Security. There were all problems not on the part of Colombia, but on the part of America. And we couldn't leave the country to come home. And it was Rush Holt and his office who really answered our pleas for help and orchestrated and helped us with everything and got us home. And I'm so thankful to him for that.
Well, Cynthia, it's good to hear from you. I remember your family situation. I hope all is well now. And it is certainly one of the pleasures of this job is getting to know the people of Central New Jersey, some wonderful people, in many cases, big-hearted people, creative, brilliant, innovative people, hardworking people. And so it is a pleasure. And I really have taken this personally. I really try to get to know the folks. And so, yes, I remember your case. I'm pleased it worked out okay at the time. And I hope everything is working well for your family now.
And Cynthia, thank you for calling. So remind us of why you ran for Congress in the first place. It's the 1990s. You're brainiacking along as assistant director of the plasma physics lab at Princeton University. And you say to yourself, what?
You know, it was just too important not to. I saw an opportunity. There was an open seat. I ran and lost. I thought maybe I'd gotten it out of my system. But 2 years later, the person who had won that seat, I thought was politically vulnerable and I actually thought should be replaced. So I welcomed the challenge of trying to win a seat as a Democrat where there hadn't been a Democrat in anybody's memory. But more important, I thought that there were so many things that needed to be done in Congress. I was really angry at Newt Gingrich, then the Speaker of the House, who was making a career in politics, a career in government, bashing the very idea of government. And I believe that there are many things we can do better together than separately. Rather than saying you're on your own, the history of this country is, yes, it is entrepreneurship and rugged individualism to some extent, but it is even more a community. I mean, you know, the words in the preamble to the Constitution, in order to form a more perfect union, it is about, you know, banding together to help each other get ahead. And in so many areas of our life, we can do better.
So I wonder
that's why I ran for office.
So I wonder how you would compare then to now, because many Washington veterans say today is the most polarized moment they have ever seen in Congress. But as you say, when you were first elected, defeating an incumbent Republican, Mike Pappas, in 1998, that was in the middle of Bill Clinton's impeachment. And during that partisan circus, everyone said that was the most mindlessly polarized time they had ever seen, with the irrational Clinton hate culture of that decade, the militia movement types, and that version, that decade's version of Tea Party radicalism, led by Newt Gingrich, as you just cited, his position against government per se. So my question is today really worse than that?
Probably, at least different, but you know, the major point you bring up here is it's good to have a sense of history. Anytime people despair about the state of the country, they talk about a dysfunctional Congress and how we'll never get back on track. I like to recount at our history as a country, where time and again the people have gotten the country back on track, it's certainly true that the witch hunts of Whitewater and all of that back in the 1990s were unfortunate, but they are. Well, today's version of that, of course, is the Benghazi, the IRS, the health care hearings that are just, you know, not aimed at getting the truth, not aimed at improving our public policy, but really aimed at scoring political points, or in some cases actually trying to render impotent or bring down the president or other people.
Let's go back to the district. Jack in North Brunswick, you're on WNYC with departing Congressman Rush Holt. Hi, Jack.
Yes, good morning. First, thank you. I've been lucky enough to have the opportunity to vote for you five times since I've been here in North Brunswick. And
I hope you've taken that opportunity.
every time. I was a volunteer. We have lawn signs. I'm a believer. But since 98, roughly, the GDP has doubled in our country, and average incomes have barely budged. And to me, that's a sign of the problem. I would ask if you could take a look up something called Article the First, which was an amendment to our Constitution, which was passed in 1790. It was finally, I think, the ninth state to pass it was Connecticut back in 1790, but it went unreported to Congress. And what it would do would be to create one House seat for every 50,000 citizens, essentially vastly expanding the House. And we could, you know, we wouldn't have to worry about gerrymandering or too much money influencing the outcomes of our elections.
Right. I'm familiar with that. And of course, the size of a congressional district back in 1789 was considerably smaller than it is today. Mm-hmm. You know, there are arguments that, as you say, you'd need less money for communicating in a campaign. You would have be closer in touch with the individuals that a representative represents. So there are some arguments in favor of it. It just seems to me that it would be so unwieldy to have a legislature that large. Part of legislating is the personal interaction among the legislators. You know, some people like to disparage it, talking about log rolling or backroom deals. But in fact, this kind of give and take and compromise among the legislators is what makes, I think, over the last couple of centuries, what has made the system work, or one of the necessary ingredients of making the system work. And I think a legislature of thousands of people would be unwieldy. And so, in fact, you might have, you know, closer personal association between the representative and the constituents, but a much less personal interaction among the legislators who actually have to put the legislation together. Mm. And that's why I would need more convincing to want to go to such a system.
So, Jack, thank you for your call. And if you're talking about the value of having those relationships with the other members of Congress, and you talked before about union and community, after rubbing elbows with members from all over the country, do you get the Tea Party, and I mean this as an earnest, serious question, do you find that those members and the people they represent are just corporate sharks out for profits over all other notions of fairness or social justice, or are they just ordinary Americans with grievances and values that tend to be quite different from what you find in your safe Democratic district in central New Jersey?
Well, the Tea Party feeds on legitimate and real frustrations. But the actual practice of the Tea Party, you know, I mean, it's gotten huge funding from real special interests.
Koch brothers and people like that.
For example, yes. So this is not a people's populist movement the way that it is sometimes portrayed. But there are real frustrations about, a loss of power, a loss of, by the people, or a poor return on their taxation or whatever. But instead of really addressing those issues, well, how do we get value for our taxation? I mean, we do want to raise revenue if you believe, as I do, that there are things that we can do better together than by saying you're on your own. Then we need to raise revenue, and as Holmes said, pay the price of civilization by paying the taxes. The Tea Party instead is taking a nihilist approach and saying, we're frustrated, let's tear everything down. And now, the way that's reflected in Congress, it varies. As I mentioned earlier, there's a wide variety of people in Congress, and some of them are would-be demagogues. Some of them are just willing to follow the political fashion of the day. Some of them want to. Most of them. I should have said this first. I hasten to say, are altruistic, hardworking, patriotic Americans. And really are in it for the right reason. So, but some of them who are taking on the mantle of the Tea Party are doing it for it's a small number. I mean, even when we decry the Tea Party's influence in Congress, you have to remember this is only a minority of the Republican Party.
Right.
Unfortunately, they've been allowed to get more influence than they deserve, and I fault the Speaker on that. But I don't envy the Speaker's position trying to manage the Republican Conference. But anyway, only some of them are really disingenuous or manipulative or taking advantage of this Tea Party sentiment.
By the way, if I could digress from Washington for a moment toward Trenton, that last caller was from North Brunswick. Rabbi Mendy Carlbach is from North Brunswick, which means he lives in your district, and he is the subject of the latest developments in Bridgegate. Do you happen to know Rabbi Carlbach?
Yeah, I was trying to remember what I know about him. I've met him,
So here's, for people who don't know, the latest Bridgegate twist is that newly discovered emails from last August or newly unredacted emails, the same week as the traffic jam is being planned at the bridge, some of the governor's aides are joking on email that maybe they should stage a traffic jam in front of Rabbi Carlbach's house, or better yet, jam up air traffic to Tel Aviv. Oh, my goodness. And he's believed to be a Christie ally who has gone on trips to Israel with the governor, posed in a photo with John Boehner. Do you get what this might have been about?
Here's what I think it was about. It was about people being cavalier, playful, irresponsible with their power. The governmental contract is the people agree to give people in office a certain amount of power and authority in order to accomplish things for the general good. And here in the Christie office, whether it was the governor himself or not, there are a whole bunch of people who were just playing around with this power. And that is what is so offensive. It's not whether they get, they score points against the mayor of Fort Lee or against some rabbi that is pestering them or whatever. What's serious about this is that it is an abuse of power. In this case, we don't know whether they were using it for personal political gain or personal gain, but we do know that they were abusing it by, and that's an affront to the governmental contract. People are not amused by this.
I know you got to go.
They're offended by it.
You have to do a vote on the floor, I understand. Do you have regrets that you didn't run for governor last year, given what you know now?
No, I did run for Senate last year.
Right. And of course, I know you
and,
were.
And I got clobbered, but I feel very good about that race. I actually think we had the best campaign, although maybe that can't be true. If you have the best campaign, don't you win? But anyway, I think we had the best campaign, raised the issues in a very good way. I'm proud of what we did. I don't feel bad about it, although I did get clobbered at the polls.
Congressman Rush Holt, who has announced that he will leave Congress at the end of this year after 8 years, 16 terms, and will try to have an impact on public policy in other ways after serving his Central New Jersey district in the House of Representatives. Thanks so much for coming on with you. We'll
Brian,
keep talking.
A pleasure to be with you. And by the way, I'm still around. I'm still a representative for, you know, through the year. So you'll have Rush to kick around for another 10 months, I guess.
We've got your email address.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Still to come this morning, post-Chavez Venezuela in turmoil. The Domino Sugar Factory becomes a test case for de Blasio housing policy. The pros and cons of online activism. And the Data Geek's Guide to Winning a Best Picture Oscar. Stay with us.